Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Joining me today is Christopher Graham, who just completed his doctorate in history at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. We will be discussing his article in the newly published 15th volume of the JSR entitled Evangelicals and Domestic Felicity in the Non-Elite South. Chris, congratulations on your successful dissertation defense, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you just start us off and say, what got you interested in the question of domestic felicity?
Okay, it's a kind of a long roundabout way, but your standard academic course in asking questions, I think. My initial interest going in as I entered the PhD program has always been the lives of common people in the Civil War era, and particularly the South. And when you're asking that question, when you turn that into an academic question, it always becomes, why did non-slaveholders or non-elite people support slavery or support the Confederate effort when they did? Why did common white people do what they did in the Civil War era? This article comes out of my dissertation, and in my dissertation, I look at the religious lives of common people in the South to try to explore their worldview based on their evangelical beliefs, and how an evangelical sensibility guided their day-to-day activities in the economic and social challenges of the late antebellum period and during the secession crisis and Civil War.
So along those lines, you get into the print culture. And so what effect does print culture play in shaping non-elite portraits of domestic felicity?
By the print culture, what we mean is publications by the American Tract Society, the American Bible Society, the American Sunday School Union, and denominational publishing houses. And these are usually efforts to get off the ground, usually based in the North in the 1810s, 1820s. By the 1840s and 1850s in the South, colporteurs, or the ministers who are carrying, selling tracts and newspapers and other publications, are all over the South. And they are, you know, traveling the roadsides, traveling into communities and neighborhoods and visiting, as one colporteur put it. He said, I try to visit everyone from the governor to the lowliest black man in the state. And so they're getting out and talking to everybody and selling books and publications. And they're carrying modern, what we might call modern in terms of mid-19th century American religious practices. The colporteurs, of course, are interested in converting people, but they seem to be more interested in, or rather, they learn that their greatest effect is how their presence and their publications affect the moral status of a community. Instead of converting individuals, they write back in the reports how the act of visiting a place and selling or leaving tracts or Bibles improved the morals of a place. So a place they visited that was notorious for drinking and bawdy behavior, they came back a year later and everyone was drinking coffee instead of whiskey and people were behaving. And so, and what this is, you know, is kind of representing the larger turn in American religion toward a focus on how can pious behavior be effective in supporting public morals or moral behavior in public, rather than pious behavior specifically as a thing that supports conversion or maintenance of belief within a congregation. So it's kind of religion getting out in the world. The colporteurs also were attributing rather modern, kind of romantic era literature on religion. Of course, they're still doing Bibles and Testaments and some of the classics of Protestant publication, like Pilgrim's Progress or Baxter's Call. But they're distributing as much literature that features women and children in households as the center of pious life, and particularly popular is, you know, tracts on children as the moral exemplars for the family, rather than parents or specifically the fathers as fulfilling that role.
When you focus in on Carolyn Lilly and Strong Thomason to sort of frame your article and frame some of the major themes that you're dealing with, could you talk about them?
Love to. Well, I like talking about Caroline and Strong. Caroline Lilly and Strong Thomason are individuals in Western North Carolina, where my dissertation is set, who left extensive diaries. And they're notable for not being in the planter class. Although the Lilly family did own slaves and a large farm, Caroline herself was born illegitimate into a poor family and became a teacher in her 20s and seemed to attain a surprising level of autonomy as a single woman teacher in Cabarrus County, North Carolina. She eventually married James Lilly, who was a relatively large landowner and slave owner in Montgomery County, which doesn't really mean a lot in the larger picture of the South for the size of his holdings. Strong Thomason was not a slave owner, but a landowner and a farmer in Forsyth County. What's unique about these two individuals is they're very explicit in their diaries about how they are reading the evangelical literature that is produced by the tract societies and by denominational newspapers and other magazines and items of print culture, and adapting the prescriptions of those publications into their daily lives. So Caroline, as a teacher and a mother, is reading a lot of John Abbott and Jacob Abbott's American Tract Society publications on Christian teaching and Christian motherhood. And Caroline even copies excerpts from John Abbott's books into her own diary and alters some of the language as she understands it when it comes to teaching children the value of punishment, the way you deliver punishment to a child, the value in inculcating pious morals into children. She's really enacting the prescriptions of these evangelical publications. So is Strong Thomason in the way he sets up his household. He's very explicit. He reads Arthur's Home magazine, and he's very excited about presenting these books or these compilations of articles to his future wife, Molly Bell. And again, enacting the scenes in those books in his own household. And so when he gets set up in his own, he pays attention to the furniture, the arrangement of the decorations in the house, and really enjoying kind of the scenes of domestic quietude or sacredness as he and his wife and his dog's not reading, but they're all sitting around reading on Sunday mornings, you know, evangelical literature. And he talks about, he's got a vase of, you know, red and white winter roses on the shelf, and he's got the window open, and there's a peach tree outside, and it's all very, very domestic.
And I was surprised to see how this domestic life was characterized, at least within how you framed it, by a sense of almost moral equivalency between husband and wife, and how that was a point of stress.
That's true. That's one of the major prescriptions, particularly of the denominational newspapers, is the gender relations in evangelical households. And what the newspapers insist on is that women have moral equality with men in the household. And of course, that means that in regards to how the household operates, are elevated and valued in relation to the man's. Certainly the relationship between mother and child in teaching morals and the bonding over the teaching of morals is elevated. And this is certainly all part of, you know, what historians have long called the cult of domesticity. Where this has peculiar application in the South is that in these prescriptions, the masculine imperative of men is intended to be subsumed or submerged in favor of the harmony of the household and in favor of the moral wills of the man and the woman in the household being in unison. There's a lot of very good literature now about masculinity in the South. And it emphasizes the imperative and the will for men to exert their masculinity in the household and outside of the house. What evangelical publications are describing and what James Lilly, Caroline's husband, and Strong Thomason are enacting in their own households is gender moral equality. And neither one of them exhibit ferocious masculine behavior in the household. They're always solicitous of their wives' opinions, of their health, always willing to assist them in the, lack of a better word, their women's work around the house. James substitutes for Caroline in her school teaching when Caroline is sick or pregnant. Strong cares for his wife when she's sick and does the cooking and the dishes around the house and helps with the kind of interior decorating of that, if you will, of Southern rural household. And the point is the prescriptions for the gender relations are significantly different from the prevailing secular masculine culture of the South.
I want to pick up on that last thing that you said because I think it's an important one maybe to elaborate on because it has bearing on historiography. You're bringing in this non-elite population to say that their stress is on harmony, moral equality, and peace. And what do you see as that being the contribution to how we understand family life and religion in this era and in this place?
Yeah, I think the emphasis on relative gender equality and where it comes from in the evangelical world fits into the larger reassessment of Southern social structure in the 1850s that is currently going on. And I'm thinking particularly of Jonathan Wells and Jennifer Green and their work on the Southern middle class in the 1850s. And where I think I'm adding to it is, whereas John Wells and Jennifer Green's definition of the term is based on occupation, wealth, and status, all material objects, what I'm suggesting is that as an intellectual idea, what we call middle class values, was penetrating into the Southern yeoman class at the same time, regardless of the fact that rural Southerners were still living in traditional households, still living in traditional households of extended families, a slave society, surrounded by the imperatives of slave society. But these ideas are still more broadly spread than Wells and Green have so far.
Well, let me wrap this up and where you finish, and let me just read this last sentence to you and ask you to tell us where you're heading with this. You say that the evangelical domestic ethos posed problems for the gathering Confederate nation, as its practitioners could not fully support the secessionists' brash defense of honor and patriarchal privilege. Take it away.
In regards to patriarchal honor and privilege, what I'm finding is that there are a lot of people that become Confederates that don't seem to be particularly interested or don't seem to have lived lives that prioritized the protection of honor and privilege based on race or their own skin color. But they're committed to the Confederacy for other reasons that haven't been very well developed in historiography. And those reasons are related to the evangelical lessons on faith and family. This larger evangelical ethos or sensibility that is kind of built around these prescriptions for family life make people more committed to defending homes and hearths, I believe, against the alleged depredations of the Yankee invaders when that happens. But what this does is it complicates, going along with the theme of reassessing Southern society in the 1850s, is it complicates the reasons for why Southerners supported why they seceded and supported the Confederacy ultimately. The more we historians work to understand the complexity of the South in the 1850s, the more aware we are of the bewildering array of political interests, cultural interests, social interests that complicate our view of the South that went to war in 1860 and 1861. And I don't know where this is going to go or how my work fits into it, but I'm trying to contribute to that conversation.
And this is a great way to contribute, a great thing to get us thinking about it. So we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you to Chris for joining us today. If you'd like to read his article, it is at jsr.fsu.edu. While you're there, make sure to check out the rest of Volume 15. Thank you for joining us, folks, and have a good day.